Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so for this morning, I wanted just to continue on the gradual training. I'm going to go very briefly back to the gradual training again. So back to Majjhima 27, where we are, which is kind of our base sutta. So this is the third sutta. And now we get to paragraph 17 in this sutta. So are you all clear where we are? Page 7, yeah. Okay, so page 7, paragraph 17. Okay, so this goes as follows. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, he resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. So, this we can see here what's happening here. We're moving towards meditation practice, right? This is where meditation really starts. That's why it's talking about resorting to a secluded resting place. It means like going to a secluded place, right? Where you can be alone, where you can be apart from society. This is the main meaning of seclusion. Initially, is this idea of being apart from other people and being by yourself. But you can also see from this paragraph that you only do that once you have established all these other factors, right? When they are established, that is when you are ready to resort to a secluded resting place. So you have to have the virtue. You notice here the virtue has the noble in front of it, right? It's very, very nice. Noble virtue. So if you practice the virtue fully, seclusion in monastic life, than it is in lay life. So there you are. So now we're moving towards meditation proper. This is the real deal, the real thing here. So now, before I go on and talk about the meditation practice as such, I want to talk a little bit about the process of meditation, about the experience of meditation, the sequence. And to do that, I want to move on to the 15th sutta on your list called Volition. Page 21, you have a sutta called Volition, Anguttara Nikaya 11.2. So this word volition, in case you're not familiar with that word, it means like the will, right? It's a reference to the will, the doer inside. That's what volition refers to. So this sutta here, it shows the progress of meditation, not just meditation, also outside of meditation, but it primarily refers to meditation practice. And what it shows you is what sometimes might be called the psychology of meditation. In other words, what does it feel like? What does the process feel like inside of you? How do you experience the process of meditation? That is what this is about. So it shows you how the mind changes stage by stage from the beginning, from where you start off, all the way to the very end of the Buddhist path. What is that process of mental change that happens? And this is very useful, because sometimes when you meditate, you need to have some reference points, right? How do I know I'm on the right track? How do I know that I'm actually having success in my meditation practice? If you're not having success, then you need to do something, right? You need to figure out why isn't it working, and then you can change your approach. If you don't have a clear map, if you don't have a clear system of referring to, you're at a loss to really decide whether you're making progress or not. So this is very useful as a reference point. These are like signposts on the way to know that you're heading in the right direction. So very useful to have these such signposts. The other thing about this sutta, I'll start reading a little bit, and I can can talk about some of these other factors afterwards. So it goes as follows. Bhikkhus, for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition needs to be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition, no will, right, no exertion needs to be applied. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no volition needs to be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition need be exerted. Let my body become tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no volition need be exerted. Let me feel pleasure. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no volition need be exerted. Let my mind be stilled or concentrated. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is stilled. For one who is stilled, no volition need be exerted. Let me know and see things as they really are. It is natural that one who is stilled knows and sees things as they really are. For one who knows and sees things as they really are, no volition need be exerted. Let me be disenchanted, or perhaps let me be repelled, perhaps. It is natural that one who knows and sees things as they actually are is repelled. For one who is disenchanted or repelled, no volition need be exerted. Let me become dispassionate. It is natural that one who is disenchanted becomes dispassionate. For one who is dispassionate, no volition need be exerted. Let me realize the knowledge and vision of liberation. It is natural that one who is dispassionate realizes the knowledge and vision of liberation. So I will stop there, and then we can do the last part afterwards. So this then is a sequence. This is the sequence that we are supposed to experience in meditation practice when the meditation really works, when it really takes off. You're supposed to see the sequence happening inside of yourself. And one of the important points here with this particular sequence is that it says precisely no volition, no will, no exertion is required. It is a natural progression, right? It happens basically all by itself. And this is one of the very kind of interesting and important points about this whole sequence. You don't actually have to do anything. If you establish the first factor, if you get that right, then the rest follow as a consequence. And what that means is that sometimes it means that volition actually is a hindrance in this path. Because it is a natural unfolding, volition actually gets in the way. If you try to give rise to these things, instead of putting the effort into the cause, and the cause is the first factor, if you try to give rise to these things without actually just focusing on the cause, you get in the way of that natural sequence. And this is one of the reasons, like, people like Ajahn Brahm, he teaches meditation not to do anything here, but to allow the natural sequence to arise by itself. And this is what you see specifically here. So that is one important aspect of that. The other one is that these things actually do arise. They come into existence by themselves. So if you apply yourself in the right way, they will actually happen. And this is why the first factor is so important, right? Because you get the first factor right, the rest just happen naturally, as it says here. So this is why all this emphasis we have had over the last few days about being virtuous. What does it actually mean to be virtuous? And everything, all of that is about purity. You purify yourself. You keep on practicing virtue. And if this sequence is not happening, it means the first factor isn't strong enough. That is, in a sense, the point of this particular sutta. So what happens then? Well, if you are a truly virtuous person, then you have no regrets. Abhipatisari is the Pali word for that. You have no regret. You have no remorse. You have no sense, oh, I should have done it differently. I should have done things in another way. But non-regret is actually more than just this kind of verbal feeling that you have done something wrong. It's also just, if you know sometimes you've done something maybe not slightly right, maybe you did something with mixed motives or whatever, you're trying to manipulate somebody, I don't know what it might be. You feel a sense of, there's no happiness connected with that act. There's a bit of kind of dullness perhaps, or a bit of darkness inside. It doesn't brighten up the mind. And that is also part of this idea of non-remorse, that it actually dulls down the mind. It makes it kind of dark and grey. It doesn't make it bright and clear. And this is non-remorse as it is experienced, in a sense, through emotionally. So all of this is part of that. The opposite of the reality of non-remorse then is the opposite. The mind becomes clear, the mind becomes bright. There's a natural sense of you know that you're on the right track. You know this feels good because the virtue has been established. So then when you have non-remorse, because it is a bright and clear mind, you feel a sense of gladness with that. When there's no remorse, the mind is pure, there's gladness connected with that. Again, no exertion needs to be exerted to feel that gladness. It is a natural consequence of not having remorse. So that gladness is just this feeling that you are good, right? This feeling of having a pure heart. A feeling that, you know, you are not oppressing anybody, you're not oppressing yourself. Just feeling this goodness about yourself. It's not a sense of ego. It's not, you know, I am great, I am wonderful, anything like that. It's a very natural and peaceful feeling of goodness about yourself. So this then, again, is a consequence, natural consequence of this sequence. So you can see here that you don't actually have to reflect all that much about your good qualities. It comes almost automatically. And then, because you feel joyful, then rapture arises. And rapture is really just a strengthening of that joy. So this is the point where often you will start to do meditation practice, when the joy arises. And then that joy becomes very strong, and it infuses your whole body. You can feel like, you know, pleasure in the body, waves of pleasure going through the body. And this is that piti in Pali, the rapture. And the Visuddhimagga has a long section on the different types of piti that you can feel. So the different people experience this in different ways. But it's basically just joy and a sense of happiness inside. And then you continue practicing, let's say what we're doing, anapanasati. And as you do anapanasati, things start to become more peaceful, right? Everything is about becoming more peaceful. So the joy becomes more tranquil. It is not as exciting as it was before. It becomes less exciting, becomes more peaceful. And of course, when that joy becomes more peaceful, it is also more beautiful, right? It is more pleasurable. So you're moving stage by stage to things that are more and more pleasurable, more and more beautiful. It starts to calm down. The joy becomes more refined, more beautiful. And you can see that happening inside of you. So you see what's happening. You know, clear mind, non-remorse, sense of gladness arises. And that gladness becomes stronger. It feels like rapture throughout the body. Then that rapture starts to calm down. You become tranquil. And when everything becomes very tranquil and peaceful, that is the feeling of sukha which arises, the tranquility. And then the sukha in the mind is there when things become very peaceful and beautiful. And that sukha is like a very peaceful version of the piti again. They talk about piti sukha, and sometimes it's not entirely clear what the difference is. But all of these things are the pleasure in the mind. And now we're moving towards a very peaceful kind of pleasure. So you can see here, you can sort of guide yourself. You see you have to go through all these stages. And one of the things that this tells you is that there is so much happiness to be had on this path even before you get to samadhi. You haven't even gotten to samadhi yet. And yet you have all these stages of happiness to go through. So it's a beautiful path, a beautiful way of meditation all the way through. So don't sit there waiting, when shall I attain samadhi or jhana? Because there's all this other stuff which is available there for you beforehand. So just enjoy the process as you go through it. Don't have any craving for the next stage. Just allow everything to be happy. Just because you get a little bit of piti and happiness doesn't mean you have got to jhana yet. It's even more powerful when you get to the jhanas and to the samadhi stages. What a wonderful path that is, right? All this beautiful things waiting for you, lying in stock, if you practice in the right way here. You want to? Yes, sir. Okay, yeah. The starting point is the virtue here, right? And that's the starting point. So from the virtue here, the pamoja happens by itself. So everything else is a natural process. So you have the virtue here, and once the virtue is there, then you sit down and you meditate. And if the virtue is powerful enough, the process happens by itself. You watch the breath, and this thing happens. So only focus on the virtue here. Sometimes people try to bring up piti deliberately here. It is not a very advisable thing to do, because it's supposed to happen by itself as an automatic process. Yeah. Okay, so then when the happiness is there, that is when the mind starts to become unified. And the reason, the more powerful the pleasure is, the more powerful the sukha is in the mind, the more the mind is in the present moment, right? Because it's so beautiful here. Why would you want to go anywhere else when it's so beautiful? And that means that even the slight movements of the mind start to calm down because just of the pleasure of the present moment. You become more and more focused just on that pleasure because there's nothing else that really interests you at that point. This is all that really matters. And that is how samadhi then comes about, because it's just so beautiful to be there. And this is like, you know, the stages where you have the nimittas and you focus in on these beautiful nimittas. And then samadhi happens, and then eventually part of that samadhi experience is then entering the jhana stages. So you can see here how things come about, stage by stage. So that is the most important part of this psychology of meditation. It often in the suttas you see the sequence, and it stops at that point. Actually, often it stops at the next one, which is the yathābhūta nanadassana, seeing things as they actually are. But often it stops there, because that is the most important part of the psychology of meditation. This is what you should look for and see happening in your practice when it really works. But remember, even getting to this point when you, pamoja arises, piti arises, for many people even that is quite difficult. Why? Because again, the purity, you haven't purified yourself enough. Just getting to that stage of enough purity can often take a lot of perseverance and applying yourself on the path. But then when it happens, it becomes very nice. So let us also look at the last factors here, simply for completion, for looking at the full path. So then when the samadhi is there, that means that the defilements have been abandoned completely. Because the defilements have been abandoned completely, temporarily, but completely, it means the mind is purer. There's nothing that distorts the mind anymore. Remember what the defilements do, is that they distort the mind, right? If there's any degree of sensual pleasures there, it means that the mind is distorted. That's what we were talking about before. You think that there is pleasure and happiness to be found, when actually there is not pleasure and happiness to be found. Mind looks at the world in the wrong way, essentially. So once the defilements have been taken away, then the mind is straight, it is clear, there is no distortion there anymore, and because there's no distortion, you see things as they actually are. So this is what's happening here, after samadhi, yathābhūta jñāna-dassana, knowledge and vision of things as they are, or as they have become, because things aren't really in any particular way, things are always changing, there's no core in it to anything. So you can say knowledge and vision of things as they have arisen, if you like, or have become perhaps. And then when you see things as they actually are, and this is not just something that you have to do once, you have to do it again and again, because you have to, there's, you know, the five khandhas, you have to see the five khandhas completely here in the right way. So it takes quite often, it takes a lot of applying yourself again and again. So what is it that you're seeing when you see things as they actually are? Well, what you are seeing is anicca, and because you are seeing anicca, you're also seeing dukkha, right? If something is anicca, it's also dukkha, because you can't hold on to it. It will change. It doesn't really give any lasting happiness. So if it's anicca, it's dukkha. If it's anicca and dukkha, it's anatta. So you see the three characteristics, the tilakana, that's what you actually see. And in particular, you see dukkha, right? And when you see dukkha, and when you see it fully, then just realize, I don't want to have any part of this. It is again like the simile the other day of putting your hand by accident on a hot plate, not realizing it is hot. And again, it's not, you know, you don't have to think, I need to remove my hand. It is an automatic thing. You just withdraw it automatically. And this is what happens here with the mind. When you start to see dukkha fully, the mind recoils by itself. It is like, it's almost like it's repelled by the world. But not repelled in a defiled sense, but just, oh, too much. I don't want any part of this at all. It is just all suffering. And you withdraw and you are repulsed by the world. It's a kind of wholesome type of negativity towards the world. And you just withdraw and the world just fades away. And this is what viraga is, the fading away of the world. The viraga is dispassion. It is a synonym for non-craving. So you are destroying craving when this happens. Craving, first of all, disappears temporarily, and eventually this leads to the complete destruction of craving. Viraga, you cannot crave for something that is painful, right? You cannot crave for something that repels you. Craving actually gets destroyed when you see things in this way. And this is how it happens. And then when craving gets destroyed, then you have liberation, and you have the knowledge and vision of liberation. You know that you are liberated. You don't come to the end of the path and you have no idea you're there. If you're at the end of the path, you know this is the end of the path. I have destroyed craving. You know rebirth has come to an end, and there's no more suffering in that sense in the future. So that is the whole path for you there, distilled in this short sutta called Volition. And this is how it happens, all by itself, stage by stage, all the way through. So no volition is required. In fact, volition gets in the way. If there is a need for volition, it is only for the very first factor to get you established. So let us continue the sutta and read it to the end. Thus, because the knowledge and vision of liberation is the purpose and benefit of dispassion. Dispassion is the purpose and benefit of repulsion. Repulsion is the purpose and benefit of the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. The knowledge and vision of things as they really are is the purpose and benefit of samadhi, of stillness. Stillness is the purpose and benefit of happiness, pleasure, sukha. Sukha is the purpose and benefit of tranquility. Tranquility is the purpose and benefit of rapture, piti. Piti is the purpose and benefit of joy, pamoja. Pamoja is the purpose and benefit of non-regret. And non-regret is the purpose and benefit of virtuous behavior. So virtuous behavior drives this whole sequence. Remember, virtuous behavior here means purity, both lack of negative qualities, but also the development of the good things, right? These things go together. Sila is both of these. Thus, because one stage flows into the next stage, one stage fills up the next stage. I've changed the translation there a bit because it is not quite correct as it stands. One stage fills up the next stage for going from the near shore to the far shore. So one stage flowing in means, the Pali says, dhammas flow into dhammas. The word dhamma in Pali is very broad. It means many different things, but often it has a sense of quality of the mind, right? So certain mental qualities flow into other mental qualities. They kind of transform themselves and become new ones. It's like a path of transformation where gradually the mind transforms, transmutes from one thing to another one, more and more beautiful as you go along. And each one fill up the next one. As if one before becomes complete, the next one starts to arise. When the next one starts to arise, it expands and completes itself. The next one arises, right? The early one fills up the next one, stage by stage, going through like this. So this is the process. It's a gradual development that happens in meditation practice when it works in the right way. So that, there you are. That is, in a sense, the psychology of meditation, the process that you should be on the outlook for, and the signposts on the road, and you know that things are going right if this is happening. So now I want to look in a bit more detail how this happens in practice. And now go back about three suttas back. So that is page 20, the Mahanama Sutta, Anguttara 6, number 10. So this is an example of how this happens. Mahanama, he was one of the cousins of the Buddha, and he was a noble disciple. He was an Arya Pugala, which means that he had seen the Dhamma. He was a stream entry, right, a Sovan, Sotapanna. So because of that, this really relates to stream entries, this particular passage. But if it relates to stream entries, it also relates to other people, but to a slightly lesser degree. But it relates to everybody, at least to some extent. But it gives a very clear idea how this process actually takes place. So this is the Buddha speaking to Mahanama. This is just an extract of this sutta. Before this point, just to let you know what's happening before this point, the Buddha is teaching Mahanama about the Buddhanusati, Dhammanusati and Sanghanusati, the recollection of the triple gem. That's what happens before here. And once he has taught him that, he goes on to talk about Silanusati. This is the Silanusati, recollection of virtue, right? The recollection of Sila. So this is now the Silanusati. And this is how that happens. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects his own virtuous behavior as unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped and leading to concentration. When a noble disciple recollects his virtuous behavior, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, by hatred or anger or delusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on virtuous behavior. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, this is the Pamoja of the previous sutta, when he is joyful, rapture arises, piti arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure, sukha. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled or concentrated. You can see it stops at that point. This is called a noble disciple who dwells in balance amidst an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of virtuous behavior. So this is the recollection of the stream entry. So of course, for a stream entry, this reflection will be very powerful, because one of the qualities of the stream entry is that he or she has perfected virtue, right? Virtue is perfected, so they know inside of themselves that they are pure in that respect. So because of that, this becomes a very powerful reflection, and it takes them through these stages pretty much automatically. For all of us who are not stream enterers, it's not as easy as that, right? Because we don't have the same confidence in our own virtue as a stream enterer has. Nevertheless, a similar kind of process happens also with anybody who has sufficient virtuous behavior. That's what I mean. This definitely applies 100% to the stream enterer, but it also applies to the rest of us to a certain degree here. So you recollect your own virtuous behavior as unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched. This is how the stream enterer thinks, because his virtue is so powerful. This does not mean that the stream mentor is absolutely always does everything right. They can make mistakes. But as soon as a stream mentor makes a mistake, he or she will confess that mistake and purify themselves of that mistake that they did. It is freeing. Buddhissa. Freeing means like leading to basically like awakening, basically. And it is freeing in two senses, in the sense that being virtuous is freeing here and now. You feel free here if you are virtuous. You're free of all the negative states that come from not being virtuous. You have the non-remorse, right? There's a sense of freedom that comes from virtue. So although you are bounded by these rules, although the rules kind of limit what you can do, the sense of freedom in the mind is what really matters. That's what we're trying to achieve. So you're binding yourself, but paradoxically, you're also becoming more free. And it is freeing also in the sense that it leads to freedom, right? So freeing in both those senses. Freeing here and now, leading to freedom in the future. It is praised by the wise, praised by the Buddha, praised by anyone who has any understanding of the power of virtue. And this is the thing about being an Arya, is that you understand for the first time the power of virtue, what it actually means. You understand that not being virtuous is not really a choice. Why on earth would anybody not be virtuous when you understand the power of virtue? Virtue is what gives you happiness, it's what drives you forward on the path. Not to be virtue is madness from the Sotapanna's point of view. It becomes absolutely something you cannot possibly think about anymore, not to be virtuous. So that's why it's praised by the wise, because it is so obvious that this needs to be done. And it is ungrasped, and that is one of the interesting factors as well, for the stream entry. This is apparamatta is the Pali. It means something like roughly like non-grasped. And again, this is because for the stream entry, virtue is natural. They don't have to tell themselves, oh, I must be careful, I must be virtuous. It comes naturally for the stream entry. So they don't have to grasp onto it, they don't have to hold on, they don't have to try very hard, it just happens by itself. For the rest of us, a little bit of attachment to virtue is good. You know, to say to yourself, okay, I will try my best to be virtuous. Because a little bit of attachment means you try a little bit harder. So sometimes, because you're not the stream entry yet, you need that little bit of grasping to be able to make it work properly. So, and then lastly, leading to concentration, leading to purity of mind, leading to happiness, leading to the ability of the mind to unify itself. Which means, of course, that lack of virtue leads the opposite way, right? It leads to lack of concentration. So, when that noble disciple recollects his virtuous behavior, on that occasion the mind is not obsessed by the defilements. Lust, it says here, means any kind of desire connected with the five senses, right? Hatred, any kind of ill will and negativity. Delusion, any kind of confusion and non-seeing according to reality. So, here, the recollection that is done here is a very general recollection. It's a recollection of the general fact that you have virtuous behavior. It's not really so much a recollection of specific instances. So you can see here just the general feeling, the knowledge that you are virtuous is what this recollection is about. And in general, there's different ways you can do the recollection of virtue. You can focus on the fact that you are keeping the five precepts, for example, and that can give you a sense of happiness. But you can also think about specific instances, particularly if you think about instances in the past when you did something nice, and that was a time when you had happiness, you had a sense of gladness about what you were doing, and sometimes it's quite easy to recreate that sense of pleasure that you had at that time, to recreate it now. It's like you have to tune into that time, and when you tune into that occasion, it tends to re-arise also here and now. So this is just two ways of remembering virtue. Remembering virtue as a general principle that I am virtuous, or focusing on specific situations. And this comes even more with generosity, thinking about specific situations. And when you do that, the mind is not obsessed by the defilements. And that means that the defilements are still there in a subtle form, but it's almost like they're not really visible. They're not really prominent in the mind. You don't think about sensual pleasures. You're not obsessively angry with anybody, but they might be like in a little bit in the background. There's still some slight hindrances left at that particular point. The mind isn't 100% pure, but it's pretty pure at this point. And on that occasion, the mind is simply straight. Ujjugata. Ujju is straight. And again, this is this idea that when there is defilements in the mind is crooked. It's like bent. You're bending your mind to see according to the defilements rather than seeing according to reality. You cannot see things properly here, and that's why it isn't straight. At this point, because the defilements are very weak, the mind is called straight. It's not yet Yathābhūta Ñāṇadarśana, but you're heading in that direction. And then, when the mind is straight, you feel the inspiration in the meaning, the Atta, and you feel inspiration in the Dhamma. The Dhamma and the Atta. Dhamma is the teaching of the Buddha, right? The Atta is the goal, the purpose, the meaning of those teachings. So you have inspiration in the teachings themselves and in the meaning of those teachings. You realize how wonderful these teachings are, because all they do is bring you happiness and peace and joy, tranquility, compassion, kindness, all these things is what these teachings give you. You know, how could you not get inspiration in teachings like that? And then you think about the goal, where this is all heading. It's heading towards this, ultimately, of course, the goal is Nibbana, right? Because as an Arya, you understand what Nibbana is. You understand that it is the highest happiness that anyone can achieve in this world. Of course, again, you have this incredible inspiration when you hear about this. You know that you are heading in that way. You understand that you have a chance to achieve the highest happiness possible for a person, for any kind of being. And if anything is wonderful in the world, surely that must be the most wonderful thing of all. So you can see how this becomes a very powerful emotion for an Arya in particular. And we can all kind of slightly move in that direction. We all have some idea of what Nibbana is. We know that Nibbana is a movement towards peace, a movement towards reduction in suffering. And that is enough to actually have some feeling for the meaning of that word. So you can also, each one of us can also have some of this inspiration in the Dhamma. Inspiration is Veda, Dhamma Veda, Atta Veda. This word Veda is in the Pali is a mixture of feeling. It means like feeling on the one hand, like Vedana. Vedana is derived from the same thing, Vedeti, to feel. But it also is related to the same root as Vidya. Vidya is knowledge, understanding, right? So it has both the sense of understanding and feeling at the same time. An inspiration in English is a bit like that. When you are inspired, you feel good, right? You feel happy, you're inspired about something. But you also have an understanding of that topic that inspires you. So this mixture of understanding and feeling. And this is one of the things about the Buddhist path. It is precisely a mixture of feeling and understanding. It is about feeling, good feelings, developing the positive feelings, and also understanding. The whole path is really about how one way the path can be seen is that like the mixture of these two things working together, feelings and understanding going together. A path that is just understanding is dry, it lacks something, and it's never going to lead to full penetration. You have to have the feelings, and just the feelings, just the happiness is not enough. That's like just practice in the Brahma Viharas. That's also not enough. So when the two come together, that is when the path really works. So the inspiration in the Dhamma, the inspiration in the meaning, Atta Veda, Dhamma Veda, and he gains joy connected with the Dhamma, right? This inspiration is like joy. When you're inspired, you are joyful. And there you are. The joy, Pramoja, is just that Pramoja we saw before in that sequence that the mind should go through for actually gaining Samadhi. So you arrive at joy here based on the recollection of virtue. And then when the joy arises, then this whole thing takes off by itself. You just sit back. At this point, you can just watch the breath. Sometimes you don't even have to watch the breath, but you can easily watch the breath at this point. And then the sequence develops, right? From the joy comes the piti. From the piti, you start to calm down. You feel tranquility. It says here, tranquility of the body. So the tranquility comes to the body first. And then the second aspect is also the tranquility of the mind. And when the mind comes down, then you feel the pleasure, and then the mind becomes still. And that is Samadhi. And that's where it stops. And it often stops at that particular point, just like the Eightfold Path stops with Samadhi. Because then you have really done the work. You have achieved like the first major kind of stepping stone on the path of the Dhamma, and you're getting very, very close there to Nibbana itself. So this is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amidst an unbalanced population. Sama is like even. Sama in Pali means even. You are even. You don't kind of, you know, jump back and forth. You don't lose the path and gain the path. The path is always there for you. You have internalized the Noble Eightfold Path. So you are even in your practice. Your virtue is permanent. It's always there. For the rest of the population, for the rest of us, we try to practice. Sometimes we succeed. Sometimes we don't succeed. So it's much more uneven. He dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted population, because the stream enter has already abandoned the vast majority of suffering. Only a little bit of suffering remains, whereas for most people there's a lot of suffering still to be dealt with. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma. The stream of the Dhamma is, this is why they're called stream enter, right? Once you enter that stream, once you have internalized the Eightfold Path, the Eightfold Path carries you along. It's not, you don't have a choice anymore. You get carried along with that stream, and that stream ends in Nibbana. It ends with becoming with arahantship. So you get carried along by the stream. At this point, there's no choice anymore. And it's a happy no choice. You don't want to have a choice. You want to be carried along by the stream, because it is a happy stream, and the result is happy as well. And he does that by through developing the recollection of virtuous behavior. So again, you see the power here of virtue, right? Virtue, when developed properly, has incredible power to it. And that is what the Buddha is saying here. So that is the one way. And then, of course, another way is to develop the recollection of generosity. And this is what comes in the next paragraph here. So this is also one of the classical recollections you find in the suttas. So the Buddha says to Mahanama, again Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects his own generosity thus. It is truly my good fortune and gain that in a population obsessed by the stain of miserliness, I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of miserliness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. When a noble disciple recollects his generosity, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred and delusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on generosity. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. This is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amidst an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of generosity. So here you have the recollection of generosity. See there how he says at the beginning, it is truly my good fortune, again, that in a population obsessed by the stain of miserliness, I am actually generous. So you rejoice in your own generosity. You don't feel kind of bad that you are generous and other people are stingy. You don't look down upon other people and think that they are bad because they are not generous. You simply rejoice in your own generosity. And again, the reason why you can do that and why you're not concerned with other people is because you understand that generosity is a very powerful thing and a very beautiful thing. And you want to do it because it's beautiful. If other people are not generous, it's actually their problem, right? They have a problem when they're not generous, because you understand that this is something that drives you on the path. It's something that gives rise to enormously good results. And that's why you rejoice in that generosity. And that's why you want to give as much as you possibly can. And that's why you have the rule in the Vinaya for the monastics, for the monks at least, for the monks, that says that if somebody are so generous because they are sekhas, because they are in training, because they are Aryas, that at that point in particular, you see that they are too generous. They're so generous that they give away everything. and you know they can't feed themselves properly, they can't kind of live properly in the house anymore. That's how generous people become sometimes. And then the monastics are not supposed to go to their house to receive alms. You're supposed to be very careful with approaching that kind of people, because basically they have too much faith, too much inspiration, and then the children starve, right? So you have to make sure that their children survive, otherwise there will be no Buddhists in the future. No, that's that's not the reason. And the reason is because you have compassion for the children, right? So this is what you have to do. And then, so you can see the power of generosity. You just want to give everything because you know how powerful it is. And that is the mind of the Arya. It's interesting that there actually is a monastic rule like that, that says you have to be careful with people. So the monks, you know, monastics, we should be sensitive to people's needs and not kind of overdo the receiving of generous gifts from the lay community here. So there's always a sense of compassion for each other is very important. So freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment is vosagga rato. Vosagga is a word which sometimes has a very technical sense in the suttas, but this gives an idea of what vosagga actually means. It means giving up your material possessions, right? Relinquishing material possessions, relinquishing the objects of the senses, of the five senses. Devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing, finding happiness in that. And then when you do that, you find that it's exactly the same sequence as you had before, because you're delighting in it, your generosity, your mind is not obsessed by the defilements, it is straight. And then this whole sequence happens just like in the previous one. Your mind then becomes concentrated or stilled. And this again is that noble disciple who is practicing in the right way. So that is for the noble disciple, and we can all approximate that kind of thing. When you think about generosity again, you can do it like this. You will notice again, this is a general reflection on generosity. You're reflecting that you have a generous heart, full stop. You are generous basically all the time because you have an open heart, willing to share and give. Sometimes that can be difficult, so sometimes you can reflect on specific instances of generosity. You think back, you did something beautiful. Sometimes when you do something spontaneously, you feel a sense of joy right there and then because you've done a spontaneous act of kindness, right? So bring those to mind. Bring back that memory of a good feeling you had when you did something kind. And then that can become a basis again for purifying the mind and then aiding the meditation practice. Okay. It's also interesting that in other suttas you find this idea of generosity, and it says that unless you have this generosity inside of you, it is impossible to enter the first jhana. So the mind has to be completely open, completely giving, completely free in that sense to be able to enter samadhi. If you have any sense of stinginess, which is like basically a self-centered kind of thought, right, then the samadhi becomes impossible. So somebody who has deep samadhi will also be a very generous person. Okay, so that is for the Aryas, and we try to approximate that. But the next sutta here, this very short extract from the Nandiya Sutta, this tells you how it is for non-Aryas. Because Nandiya, as far as I know, and that is how he seems to come across in the suttas, he was not an Arya, and yet the Buddha taught him as well, right? So how did it teach him? And this gives you some feeling for how he would teach non-Aryas. This is just a very short passage. And it's interesting here because this passage comes in the place where usually you have the recollection of the Sangha for the Aryas. But for the non-Aryas, you actually recollect good friends instead. You recollect your Kalyanamitas instead of recollecting the Sangha. You can probably do both, but in this case, it's the Kalyanamitta instead. So the Buddha says to Nandiya, and again, the sequence of things is quite similar to the previous sutta, in the sense that he talks to Nandiya about recollecting generosity, virtue, the Buddha, the Dhamma, etc. And then he has here the Kalyanamitta recollection. So again, Nandiya, you should recollect good friends, Kalyanamitta, thus. It is truly my good fortune and gain that I have good friends who take compassion on me, who desire my good, who exhort and instruct me. Thus, you should establish mindfulness internally based on good friends. So you can see, because this is to non-Aryas, it's a bit less lofty than the previous one. The main thing here is just to establish mindfulness. But if you establish mindfulness, it's similar to the previous one, because when you have mindfulness, the defilements are down and joy tends to arise in the mind. So it is a similar kind of thing. And here you are recollecting the good friends. Because you are not an Arya, you cannot really fully understand what the Arya Sangha is, what a noble person is. So here you just think in more general terms that you have good friends who teach you in a good way, who help you out in a good way. And of course, the Kalyanamitta, it is true, of course, it is about the ordinary friends you have. But the real Kalyanamittas on the Buddhist path are the teachers, right? Somebody who knows something you don't know. Somebody who has experienced some of the Dhamma which you may not have not experienced. They are the true Kalyanamittas. And in the end, the ultimate Kalyanamitta is, of course, the Buddha himself. He is the real Kalyanamitta for all of us. So that is the true one. So, of course, and this is the point, the Buddha has compassion on us. He desires our good, and he exhorts and instructs us. So think how wonderful it is that I have these suttas, how wonderful it is that I have, you know, good teachers who can help to explain the path in whatever way. What a wonderful thing that is. What a wonderful thing that I have all these friends who I can practice together with, who kind of draw me along in the right direction, so I don't kind of fall into the stream of craving and head in the wrong way. So, that is the Kalyanamitta, and this is how we use this recollection to further us in the Dhamma. Now there is one more sutta that I thought I would read out before we take a break, before we continue with this meditation practice. And this is about the importance of the Kalyanamitta. And this is an interesting little sutta. I'm sure you have heard this before. It's a very famous one. Nevertheless, it is worthy of a little bit of reflection, I feel. So I will just read this one out, and then I will make a few comments. It will be pretty quick. So this is the one called Half the Holy Life, from the Samyutta Nikaya. This is from the Magga Samyutta on the Eightfold Path. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans, where there was a town of the Sakyans named Nagaraka. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life, that is, good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship." This is the Kalyanamitta, right? This is half of the holy life. Not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu, anyone, has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. And how, Ananda? And then it goes on to explain the Noble Eightfold Path. But let's just stop there for a while, because this is a very interesting statement. It's something you hear all the time. People say that noble friendship is the full of the holy life, all of the holy life. But what does that actually mean, that it is all of the holy life? Does it mean that everything else is irrelevant, that virtue doesn't matter, all these things? Sometimes people think, but what about virtue? What about generosity? What about kindness? What about compassion? Isn't that part of the holy life as well? How can good friendship be everything? Does that mean all we have to do is hang out with our good friends? And no, it doesn't mean that. What it means, and I think it's important to remember, when the Buddha says that it is the holy life, the Buddha doesn't use the words in a vague and approximate sense. He doesn't say that to inflate the idea or to make some kind of point which isn't precisely true. If the Buddha said that, it is precisely true, at least in a certain way, right? So this is very important. So to understand how the Kalyanamitta can be the holy life, you have to remember a few things about the nature of the Dhamma, the nature of reality here. And of course, one of the things that we talk about in Buddhism is this idea of no self. So if there is no self, it means that there's nobody inside of us guiding us, you know, independent of external conditions. There's nobody inside of us that kind of can chart out a path and say, this is the right way here. Everything we do is dependent on external things coming in from the outside. If we are like, you know, I like to use the idea of being like a ship on the ocean, but a ship without a rudder, without a steering mechanism. Now, a ship without a steering mechanism, if the wind comes from the east, it will go to the west, right? If the wind comes from the west, it will go to the east. The wind comes from the south, it will go to the north. So whatever the conditions are, you will just drift along according to the conditions. And people are basically like ships without rudders. We drift along in the world according to whatever conditions us. So we are completely dependent on external conditions. So if we do get conditioned by something positive, we will go in the right direction. And what is that positive thing that conditions us? The Kalyanamitta, right? And in the end, this is the driving force that gets us in the right direction. This is the only thing, the only condition in the world that can actually push us in the right direction. So that is why the Kalyanamitta is 100% of the holy life. It is based on that that we practice generosity. It is based on that that we practice virtue. It is based on that that we have compassion and kindness. It is all because we have learned these things, or we have been the conditions outside have actually made us do these things. That is why it works. So the Kalyanamitta is in fact 100% of the holy life. And if you look at in the Anguttara Nikaya, at the very beginning of the Anguttara Nikaya, there's a whole load of conditions that are said to be the foundations. This is the most important condition for, how does it go again now, precisely those in the beginning there. I think basically the most important condition for the practice of the holy life, or something like that. My memory fails me a little bit right now. And he mentions a number of things, right? The kind of root conditions. I mean, one of them is apamada, right? If you haven't got that heedfulness, that carefulness in your practice, that diligence in the practice, of course, you're not going to go anywhere. Another one is yoniso manasikara. And there's a few factors like that. And one of them is the Kalyanamitta. It's a foundation stone for the holy life, for the practice of Buddhism to become possible. So there you are. Again, sometimes you need to reflect on these simple statements to actually understand the power. And this is why, if there is no Buddhism in the world, if there is nobody who has understood the Dhamma, penetrated these things, then you have no Kalyanamitta, and there is no beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path, because right view doesn't exist, right? You can't even get started. So Kalyanamitta is 100% of the holy life. And then, I think that probably is the main point I wanted to make there. The rest of the sutta just shows you that based on the Kalyanamitta, that is how you practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Based on that Kalyanamitta, that is how you make an end of suffering on that basis. That's really all it shows. And we're going to, of course, look more at these practices later on anyway. Okay, so that is all for this morning, and we will continue again this afternoon. So let us pay our respects together to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.